Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast where I've got Dr. Anas Alhaji from a previous Twitter space. He came and joined the program. He's absolutely outstanding. Go ahead and check him out at Anas Alhaji on X. And feel free to hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcast. Tell a friend to tell a friend. Join the Green Candle brand and support me and everything that is going on here at Green Candle. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Whoosh. We've got an action-packed show planned for you all. A lot of great things going on in the OPEC and everything else as well. This is also a recorded space, so feel free to send this one around to anybody that may be interested in it, following this space as well. Tell people to hop on in. But Dr. Anas, we can kick it off here, right off the bat. We had crude oil come in, get dropped to a price of $69. We've got a lot of developments in the oil market with OPEC Plus and the huge decline that we're seeing. So I'll start it off the bat if you're ready to go. What kind of reasoning do you think is for the recent developments and the recent price drop?
Sure. Thank you very much for the invitation. And it's always a pleasure to be on your space. Let's start with this. We have OPEC, and we have OPEC Plus, and then we have the group of eight that I labeled V8. The group of eight is different from OPEC and OPEC Plus, that they are the eight countries that voluntarily cut production. And that's why I use V8, V4 voluntarily, or volunteer, and whatever you want to use. But this V8 refers to that. There was a big mistake in the media and by many analysts in the last 10 days or so when they were reporting that OPEC cut production, OPEC extended, or OPEC Plus extended the voluntary cuts. No, this has nothing to do with OPEC Plus. This has nothing to do with OPEC. It's a completely different entity. In a sense, it's an entity within OPEC Plus. So it has nothing to do with OPEC Plus. And it was very clear, we published a report the day before their announcement of extending the cuts, trying to think about what are the possibilities. And we had two scenarios. One scenario is if they get confirmation that the countries that been violating their production targets, and specifically Iraq and Kazakhstan, if they follow their quota and they compensate for their overproduction in the first 7 months of the year, then if they unwind production as they planned starting October 1st, then the impact on the market will be very limited because the compensation will eat up almost all the additional production. So the additional production, if they unwind, is about 180. If those countries fulfill their promises of compensating, they will cut by about 150. We are left with about 30,000, most likely Saudi Arabia and the UAE and others will not increase production. We end up with zero increase in production. So if they do that, then there will be no impact. And the second scenario was to delay everything by one quarter. However, our suggestion or our scenario was, instead of delaying everything by one quarter, is just taking the fourth quarter of 2024 and literally placing it as is at the fourth quarter of 2025. They did not do that. Basically, they decided just to push everything by 2 months. So the extension of the voluntary cuts ends at midnight on the 30th of November. Why they chose 2 months and why this date is very important? because the OPEC Plus meeting is on the 1st of December, which means that they really wanted to have a concrete action, and they wanted everyone participating on one side, and they want those eight, the V8 wants to meet face to face and discuss what is the next step. It is very clear that the leadership of the group, not OPEC, because I'm going to talk about OPEC today and OPEC report that's been released this morning. This group realized the truth about the market and the reality of the market. They realized that demand growth is not as strong as earlier predictions. So they decided, and they knew this since late 2022. So they started cutting, and they have the voluntary cuts. Then above the voluntary cuts, the Saudis have additional voluntary cuts on their own for a month. Then they extended that for a second month. So they realized that there are problems in the market early before others. And when they decided to delay the unwinding of the voluntary cuts, it is very clear they knew that they would have some serious problems in the market. The issue now is OPEC report. OPEC released, we have several reports being released today, by the way, this morning. That's why today was kind of a great day to have this space. At the same time, we have the debate between Harris and Trump. This morning, we had several reports. The first one is from OPEC. Last month, for the first time, OPEC realized that they have to cut their estimates for global oil demand. For those who follow us and read our reports, whether the daily energy report or the newsletter, we've been talking about this since December 2023, that look, OPEC is exaggerating the growth in oil demand. Their numbers are too high. There is no way we can have that. So our followers, basically, they knew this long time ago. And we were surprised that OPEC just continued to claim that world oil demand will grow by 2.2 to 5 million barrels a day, which is impossible based on all the data that we've been collecting. Last month, they decided, okay, well, it looks like that's the case. So what is the problem with OPEC? The problem with the OPEC report is this. There is something called the call on OPEC. What is the call on OPEC? The call on OPEC basically is you take the world oil demand estimates, you take non-OPEC production estimates, you subtract them from each other, that's the call on OPEC. Now, as you know, in recent months, they switched to OPEC Plus. But the whole idea is still the same, because in our reports, on Substack, basically, we switched with them to start to OPEC Plus, but we still get the same results. If you look at OPEC reports, they've been always calling on OPEC or OPEC Plus to, listen to this, increase production. At the same time, when the group was cutting production, OPEC reports were calling on them to increase production. And that does not make any sense. That tells you how bad those estimates are. Luckily for the world, luckily for everyone, the Group of Eight and the leadership of the Group of Eight and the Saudis do not believe in OPEC reports. While OPEC report was calling for growth in oil demand like 2.25, the Saudis, the head of Aramco said it publicly in the media. He said our estimate is 1.5. We are talking about 750,000 barrels a day difference. This adds up to millions if you want to talk about the whole year and the impact on inventories. So that's one problem. The other problem we have, which is kind of really outrageous, that they cut the estimates this morning. They said, okay, well, it's no longer 2.2, it's 2. And that's what the media basically be reporting. But no one questioned what they've done. And there is a serious problem. All this decline, the 200, did not come from the outlook. They revised the Q1 and Q2. That's the past. And that's a very serious problem. That means they exaggerated those numbers. Now, the irony is they blame others for exaggerating things in the market, et cetera, but they are the one who've been exaggerating. And when we talk about oil prices, because the main question is, why have oil prices declined? Why have oil prices declined? Whether TV interviews, on spaces, and podcasts, I get this question all the time. This is really, from our point of view, from our estimates, since we've done this since December of last year, when OPEC and others basically have various estimates, our growth, our estimate for growth in demand was 1.48. OPEC was 2.25. So there's a big difference here. But from our point of view, based on our estimates, there are serious problems, especially in Q1. So just to give you how outrageous those estimates were, in Q1, OPEC estimated the growth in demand to be 2.4 million barrels a day. How much was the number for IEA? 800,000 only. So when I get asked on various interviews, why have oil prices declined? This is the wrong question. The right question is, why oil prices were high in the first half of the year? If you answer that, then you know everything going on right now. Because prices, our range was 78 to 84. Anything above 84, we said, well, that was related to political premiums and other things, et cetera, which is the exaggeration of Goldman Sachs and the rest of the banks and those who are calling for $100 oil and those who, there is one who called for 120, and OPEC when they call for a demand of 2.25 million barrels a day. So prices were, from our point of view, were not justified. At 90, the only justification we had was, okay, it's political premium. But even when you look at political premium, what we are talking about here? There was no shortage. There was no damage to oil facilities. Israel does not produce oil. Gaza does not produce oil. Lebanon does not produce oil. So what is the problem? Well, the Houthis were attacking ships. Well, the ships went around, okay, got delayed 6 weeks, so what? We still get the oil. So there was no justification for the higher prices earlier. So probably we have to take out probably like $6, $7, $8 out of those prices to understand the current decline. So that's one part of the story. The other part of the story that the decline, or let me rephrase that. Because we have people who were predicting, or influential people, influential organizations, who were predicting higher demand and higher prices. Why they did that? Because they assigned higher demand for China, United States, and India. At the same time, we are in an election year. In the United States, we had elections in India. And the level of exaggeration from the media was unbearable for someone who is looking at the details, looking at the numbers, looking where the media is going, looking where social media is going, and reality. So they exaggerated the growth in the United States. They exaggerated the growth in India in unbelievable way. Unbelievable. If you look at what they said early in the year before the elections and what the reality is now, you will see, I mean, it's really laughable. So the forecasts exaggerated the demand and exaggerated prices, and now all of us are paying the price for that. But when you look at where the sources of weakness, yes, it is the United States, yes, it is India, but the big problem is China. China's problem is way bigger than what people are talking about, way bigger. And we couldn't even get a handle on how deep the problems in China are. And add to that, it's not only that the demand got weaker, the Chinese were using their storage, their inventories, instead of importing oil. And that's lower demand from a demand point of view. As many of you know, I always emphasize the idea that we have to distinguish between demand and consumption. And this is extremely important. I mean, yes, it looks like, freshman econ 101, 18-year-old thing, but you won't believe the impact of it on the market. When you have CEOs and officials talking about strong demand, what they mean when they say, oh, we have strong demand? Well, yeah, strong demand in China because China is buying from you and they are storing that oil. They are not, their consumption is lower and therefore their economic growth is lower. So strong demand does not translate into strong economy because if they are storing that oil, and that's where part of the problem is. Because we kept hearing, oh, we have strong demand from China, strong this. Well, if they are building storage, yes, you have strong demand, but weak consumption. And that's part of the problem. The demand in China is way weaker than, we were estimating that weak economic growth and weak demand. But we still expected growth in China. Now we know, of course, the year is not over yet. And our estimates basically probably might materialize, might not. But as of today, we have a decline in demand in China. It's not like lower growth, no. Decline in demand. And the related point, and then I'll take the second question. The related point to this, which is very important, all those reports are talking about, probably demand in China has peaked, especially for gasoline and diesel because of electric vehicles and LNG trucks. And go Google it. You will see every major news agency is talking about it. Most analysts are talking about it. Well, let's look at the numbers. The numbers do not add up. And we have a serious problem. And I'm going to shock you with some information here. Between the first quarter, between the beginning of the year until now, the demand in China declined by more than 3 million barrels a day. July, oil demand in China in 2024 is lower than July 2023 by 1.7 million. So we're talking about millions. You want to take the average of the 7 months versus the average 7 months, we are talking about 800. You want to talk about forecast versus actual for the whole average, is about 800,000. When you talk about 800,000, think about it this way. 800,000 barrels a day, that's almost 200 million barrels in 7 months. Imagine if we have growth in China where we have a growth of 800,000, which is 200 million, and you have to withdraw that 200 million from storage. Imagine what prices would be today, and OPEC Plus would be increasing production today. It's a significant amount. So we have a major decrease in China. But people are telling us, oh, it's electric vehicles. Oh, it's LNG trucks. Nonsense. I'm going to give you approximate numbers so you can remember. 25% of the decline in oil demand in China is due to electric vehicles and trucks. LNG trucks, 25%. 75% have nothing to do with electric vehicles and trucks. It all has to do with lower economic growth. So this nonsense about electric vehicles and this stuff, and people have to realize this. Worldwide, by the end of this year, we will have 50 million electric vehicles in the world. On the roads. Notice the following, that the media and those who issue reports supporting electric vehicles, they will not tell you the number of vehicles on the road. They are obsessed with reporting percentages of sales, percentages of increases, but they don't give you numbers. But from an oil point of view, if you want to know to understand the consumption, and how much a replacement of oil demand, you need to know the number of vehicles on the road. sales do not matter, especially if they are replacing older electric vehicles. So you look at those numbers, and it's really stunning. 50 million electric vehicles, and of course, these are all types, including hybrid, assuming all of them basically are real cars. When I say real cars, it's not like a motorcycle converted to a car or looking like a car. These are real cars. 50 million. Their consumption, their replacement in all demand at maximum is about 1.2 million barrels a day. That's it. But this did not happen today. This has been going on since 2012. So we are talking about almost 15 years, and all the reduction in everything you see and all the hype is only 1.2 million barrels a day, and that's it. And this is a direct replacement. Notice this, a direct replacement. Why is a direct replacement? Why am I emphasizing the word direct? Because those electric vehicles, they need additional oil, additional liquids, mostly naphtha and LPG, to make bitter chemicals, to make the body of those cars lighter. So we have additional oil consumption in electric vehicles that's not being counted in the first place. Those electric vehicles consume more tires than average car. That's not even included. We did the calculations in one of the reports, and we found out between 2016 and 2022, the additional tire replacement on electric vehicles consumed 60,000 barrels a day. 60,000 barrels total, not a day, total. That's 60,000 barrels, no one counted that. So 1.2 basically is the replacement, and that's not the net, this is the gross. You go for the net and it's way lower. For total, in the first 7 months, I told you the decline in China when it comes to oil demand is in millions. You remember when I mentioned 3.2 or I mentioned 1.7, July over July. All the car being sold, all the EVs, almost 6 million EVs in the first 7 months of the year, and all the LNG trucks being added, all their consumption, and that's the direct consumption, will not add up to 250,000 barrels a day. That's it. So the whole idea here is, yes, we have a major decline in China, but only part of it is electric vehicles and LNG. Couple of other points are important here. And please hear me out, because I'm going to say things that are crazy. Do not be surprised if we get crash in the market and just the market crashes, and blame it all on Iraq. Because Iraq being overproducing and being promising, I'm going to compensate, I'm going to cut, I'm going to compensate, I'm going to cut. They did cut some in the last 2 months. Here is what's shocking. In the last 2 weeks, their exports went through the roof. Last week, they announced they are going to cut. So, of course, 2 weeks is not enough. Probably we have to wait to see what the average for the month is. Probably they will compensate for that. Probably they have something in storage they want to get rid of. But this is really scary. And it is kind of, you have the feeling in the market that the Saudis will not take it anymore. They're already fed up. At the same time, if you think there is no coordination on oil between the Biden administration and the Iranians, you got to think again. We posted in the Daily Energy Report a chart on Monday showing the increase in Venezuela's crude and Iranian crude. And as you know, there are sanctions on both. With the help of Biden, they added 1 million barrels. So people were saying, well, shale, it's well, look, OPEC problem or OPEC plus problem is from within. both of them are OPEC members. They are not subject to the quota. They were subject to sanctions, but they added 1 million barrels. The Iraqis added a significant amount. And there is this thing that's been going around, basically, is, and I believe it, so this is not a conspiracy theory. I think many people believe this, that the Iranians who control Iraq and control the Iraqi government prefer to have Kamala Harris in the office rather than Trump. Because they've seen what happened in the last 3.5 years with Biden. They got free ride on oil production and exports, and they have more freedom to move things around. If Trump comes in, probably they are not going to have the same freedom. So increasing production from Iran, who forced the Iraqis to increase production, it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it is a believable theory that they really do not want Trump in office. Remember, Trump several times said that he wants to take Iraq's money. So in a sense, there is this sense that they don't want Trump. But the bottom line here is OPEC, or the V8, is trying its best basically to stabilize the market. The Kazakhstan already announced a very large maintenance program. They already closed two fields and they are working on them. So we will get the cut from Kazakhstan. Russia is already in compliance, whether you say because of Ukraine or other things, etc. But we still have Iraq, and Iraq basically is ignoring the quota. Here I would like to mention something I mentioned in the space a couple of days ago regarding Iraq. The head of OPEC, the general secretary of OPEC, Haitham al-Ghais, went to Iraq and met with the prime minister and the oil minister, and he delivered the message. Basically, look, you have to cut. You have to compensate. And there was a total panic that day, and they announced they are going to cut production by 180,000 barrels a day. And then the oil minister went to Kurdistan, basically, and he threatened them that they need to cut production by 100,000. As many of you know, Kurdistan basically is exporting about 250,000 via trucks, all of this smuggled, to Iran and Iraq. And this smuggling from Kurdistan to Iraq enabled the Iraqis to export more because the Kurdistan oil is being used domestically, so the Iraqi oil does not have to be used within Iraq, and therefore they were able to export more at lower prices. So the threat was real, and the threat to the Iraqi government was real from OPEC, and the threat of the oil minister to Kurdistan was real. Within 36 hours, five congressmen who are Republicans, they sent a letter to President Biden asking him to investigate the Iraqi oil minister with some really serious charges of cooperating with Iran, breaking the sanctions, playing with the dollar, smuggling dollars, smuggling this. And it turns out, basically, those five congressmen, they are the Kurdish lobbyists in Washington. So here is the guy who goes to Kurdistan, threatened them that they need to cut production, and all of a sudden they call their guys in Washington, they call the lobbyists in Washington, the lobbyists contact their friends in Congress, the five congressmen, and they write this letter to President Biden trying to scare the Iraqi oil minister so they back off. And I can tell you, if Kurdistan is not going to cut, Iraq is not going to cut, then we will have a price war. Prices will drop to 30. This is a serious problem. And those Republicans basically are dumb enough, and I'm talking about the five Republicans, they are dumb enough. If this happened before the election, it would be Kamala Harris who's going to win because prices would be low enough where gasoline prices are very low and the Biden administration can buy more oil for the SPR, et cetera, et cetera. So they did not. They because of their lobbyists, they did not pay attention to the bigger picture that if we have a price war, it's the Democrats who are going to benefit, not the Republicans. And that's a big issue. Back to you.
All right. Well, that was a great breakdown of everything that's going on here with OPEC, China, the differences between Harris and Trump.
It looks like we got a couple people waiting to request, so I'll let everybody up one at a time. We'll take a couple questions.
May I say something, a statement just quickly on Harrison Go ahead. I'm on the debate today. There is an agreement between the two parties on a couple of things. The first one is nuclear, and the second one is LNG. And I'm going to repeat what I've been saying for a long time. LNG has become an integral part of U.S. foreign policy, and it is a tool of war, whether you want to talk about trade war or you want to talk about actual war. And therefore, it is important for two parties. For the pause, the Biden pause on LNG licensing, this is a temporary pause, basically. It's an election thing, and has no impact on the current market. It has no impact on the market in the next 2-3 years. For tonight, if they talk about energy, Trump has a weak hand. And the reason why he has a weak hand, because we have, during the Biden-Harris administration, regardless of how we want to analyze it, I'm not talking about analyzing it, I'm talking about soundbite. For the soundbite, basically, during the Biden-Harris administration, the United States became the largest oil producer in the world, and we have the highest oil production in the world. We have the highest gas production in the world. We are the largest LNG producer in the world, and we are among the top exporters of crude oil. Trump cannot beat that. That's a problem for Trump. Trump is going to talk about this licensing of LNG, and that's really not a big deal because it is a temporary thing, and we have no problems in the market today. So he cannot really say much about it. Other than that, the biggest issue is the Inflation Reduction Act. That's really the biggest issue. As you all know, when they voted for it, not a single Republican in the Senate voted for it. It was 50-50, and Kamala Harris basically who broke that tie. This is the, when it comes to energy and energy policy, this is Trump's opportunity tonight, the Inflation Reduction Act, because really it's not an Inflation Reduction Act. It's something to do with climate and energy. And some Republicans already promised that if they win the houses, the first thing they will do basically is repeal the Inflation Reduction Act. And if they repeal it, and that's where the difference, the main differences are. The main difference is basically is no subsidies or very limited subsidies for renewable energy, no subsidies for electric vehicles, and all the money being going to GM and Ford basically will stop. That's really the main difference. But when it comes to nuclear and LNG, there are no problems at all. Back to you.
Gotcha. Yeah, I appreciate that insight there, Dr. Anas. But we've got a couple people here for questions, so we'll let up just one at a time, and we'll get some questions in. Jim, welcome back, and yeah, go for it.
Thank you very much, Green Candle. Hello again, Anas. I've got a question for you that's a geopolitical question, and that is that Zelensky and his troops caused in the last 60 or 65 days some trouble with Russia, with the former Soviet Union, and it was either oil fields or oil refineries or oil storage. And I can certainly tell by the price that it did not affect anything long term, but would further offensive action by the Kuwaitis against the former Soviet Union, I don't want to ask, could it affect the price? Because certainly it could. But in your opinion, is it just a small ant in that we don't care about, or could it be something significant? Thank you.
Thank you. We did. We started mapping those incidents at the beginning, and then we just give up because we don't have enough manpower to do it. But it is very clear from the early days, and I'm glad you mentioned the period, basically. It is clear that they were hitting the refineries that supply the Russian military with fuel. And then they expanded that. So in the beginning, basically, it was refineries and fuel depots that supply the military with fuel, and therefore this had no impact on the world oil markets at all. But later on, they expanded that. And as they expanded, they get a note from Biden saying that do not hit the Russian ports and the export facilities. And the reason why, because it is very clear, I mean, call it the Biden Victorian if you want to, or any other name, but it's been very clear since the end of last year that the Biden administration basically does not want high oil prices. They want to lower prices, not only because of the SPR. They just want to reduce inflation on one hand and just make people feel good on lower gasoline prices. And they fear that if they start hitting ports where Russian exports basically will decline, prices will go up. And ironically, there is an irony to this, because if Russian exports to China in particular declines, and we have enough experiences basically over the years to realize this, the Chinese are going to go worldwide and buy at any price. And that's another problem, just like compounding the problem. It's not like the Indians will go and negotiate and say, okay, if I find an opportunity, I will buy. If I don't, I won't. No, the Chinese will go and try to bid up the price as much, as high as they can just to get it. So we have this compounding effect on prices. So the Biden administration basically sent a note to Zelensky saying, look, avoid those areas, avoid this, avoid this. So he is limited basically to refineries and fuel depots. We've seen some impact, by the way. And this is one of the, again, one of the ironies of the oil market. Russia, historically, since they joined OPEC Plus in 2016, they never, ever voluntarily cut production. There were production cuts in 2016-17, and they did not abide by it. And now we have those production cuts in the last 2 years. They did not. All the reductions we've seen, basically, they were forced either because of maintenance or because of technical issues or because of the attacks. So the attacks did reduce some of the Russian supplies, because Russia historically exports products. And now what we've seen is they already restricted the exports of some of those products, so prices within Russia won't go up. So there was some impact, and they literally held OPEC Plus, making Russia comply with its quota. Thank you.
Green Candle, can I ask him one more question, please?
Yeah, go for it.
Thank you, sir, very much. Anas, may I please ask you your outlook for this winter on the natural gas price? Last year's winter was very, very mild. In the upper Midwest, they had 40s and 50 degree temperatures in all the winter months. This winter is called to be more normal to colder than normal. Can I ask you what your forecast would be for natural gas, the price of natural gas, between, let's say, December and February? Thank you.
Thank you. I cannot give you a price, but I can give you kind of a framework to work with. One of the problems we are facing right now when we are working on our natural gas models is this. We know that European storage is above 90%, and that's 2 months ahead of time. That's kind of will help them a little bit, but probably not much if we have some shortages, especially with the hurricane and now in the Gulf of Mexico. And because of prices of LNG in or natural gas in Asia are higher than Europe, we are seeing diversion of LNG carriers from Europe to Asia. If the situation in China, the way it is right now, continues until the end of the year, we have a serious problem, because China cannot import that much like it did last year, and there'll be a diversion of those tankers somewhere else. And some tankers may not find a market. And this is really a serious problem. I'm talking here about the spot market, because what they buy from the United States is really spot. It's not contracted. Japan is doing the same. It's been doing it for a few months now, right now. And it is very clear in Japan, basically, if they go for maintenance in those nuclear plants, then there is a room for LNG there. If they don't, and they add opening more nuclear plants, then they need less. So the issue for us is, seriously, in a sense, I put it this way. Give me the outlook for Japan and China, and I can give you a price. And the reason why, because if those LNG tankers are not going to find the market, then the only option for U.S. LNG plants that are affected is to go for some partial maintenance or maintenance, and that will back out gas in the pipelines, even if you have a cold winter. So that's the problem we are struggling with right now. If we see some pickup in activities in China, that will change our view, because we can guarantee that China will import more LNG. But the situation as we see it today is really horrible in China. Back to you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Awesome stuff. Thanks for coming on up, Jim. I'm going to put you down as we just rotate one person up here. All right, so we have Camille. Welcome to the stage. What you got for us? All right, you get a couple seconds here to come up and ask a question. And if I don't get to you, or if you don't ask, we've got other people waiting. So I believe Shane was next. Shane, welcome. What you got for us? Or do we have another dud? All right. Please only request if you've got questions here. We've got Eric X.
Earlier, we had a space and we had many technical difficulties with people showing up and then disappearing when you give them the microphone.
Yeah, I know. That's not always perfect, unfortunately. But Eric, welcome to the stage. Let's see if we got you, if we've got you working.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, great. Good morning. Good evening again, Dr. Anas. My question is the following. Given the current production that we have and the current plan that the OPEC countries have given and the current demand, which is lower, as we said, in China, if everything remains the same, no up or down in China, no up or down in North America, if we consider the parameters as they are, do we see a stability at these levels in oil prices, or we see that it has to be readjusted?
Given what we see today, it seems like one of the issues we are struggling with, whether the financial market is pricing some sort of recession in the view, and you can look at gold and other things, and you can see where I am going on this. Prices based on what we are having right now for Brent, given that the bad picture that I'm depicting in China today, they should be higher than what they are today. But if the market, and especially the financial part, is pricing a recession, that's a big problem. And it is very clear that if prices will go down, and we did write a report in the newsletter. By the way, we have a newsletter and we have daily energy report, so these are two separate things. The newsletter is mostly for companies and financial institutions, etc. The daily is for anyone, including individuals. But we did have a report where we investigated, or we've written the conclusion of an investigation we've done on all the price wars in the past, and what happened and what led the Saudis to increasing production and crashing the market. And we found out that all of them, all of those crashes, share the same characteristics, which made it very easy on us, basically, to make the conclusions. So there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you have those five, the market will crash. That's it. Now, we are seeing a couple of them. We haven't seen all the three, all the five. So we are seeing a couple of them right now. So the possibility of a crash is getting higher. But probably we will know very soon whether all those conditions will be met. And therefore, if we have a recession and we end up with a surplus while other members are not complying and they don't want to cut, all those five conditions for the price war will be there, where the recession will contribute to them. And therefore, we might end up with a price crash even before announcing the recession. officially. The problem with the recession is you and I can talk about it, but unless the government tells everyone, okay, well, I have two quarters of declining GDP and therefore we have a recession, that's a completely different story. But you and I can talk about it until the morning, and that does not mean anything unless the government acknowledges that we have a recession. But the point I'm making here is, and we've written this before for those subscribers, basically they have access to it. You have the conditions there. You can just look at them and look what's in the market, and you can assess for yourself if we are going to go for a market crash or not. But in case of a recession, the reaction, the typical reaction is to start cutting. The question is, what if other members do not want to cut? And that's where the big problem is. Back to you.
Thank you very much. And I took the liberty of sharing on the space there what the EIA says about their Brent expectations. A little bit funny.
Sorry, what the EIA said?
They say that they expect Brent crude oil prices to return above $80 per barrel in the fourth quarter.
The EIA lost it a long time ago, since 2017.
All right, great. I believe we had Sumit next. Welcome up to the stage. What you got for us?
Hi, sir. Thank you very much for having such a wonderful chat show. So I just wanted to understand. So, if you take a 12-month view, can you please help understand, where do you basically see Brent? If all remains status quo, no escalation in war. And of course, sir, if you can also talk about that, if Trump were to come in and the wars in the world were to end, I mean, both the wars, then do you think that whatever's priced in terms of, any geopolitical, etc., will also fade away? And then where do you actually see Brent 12 months from today, sir?
You ask four questions in one. all right. Going to end up with a crash because of, as a sort of punishment to Iraq in particular, without any recession, is going to be a flash crash. And go back to March 7th to 9th, 2020. That was a flash crash. We might end up with something similar. So it's not going to be like a crash for a very long time, because Iraq cannot handle the pressure. Iraq will go bankrupt, by the way. Iraqi government will go bankrupt immediately if we have a crash. And today in Attaqa, for those, again, I would like to mention this, that you see me tweeting a lot of things in Arabic and retweeting from Attaqa. Attaqa is the only media in Arabic, basically, that is energy-focused. And it's a wonderful organization with amazing people. And today they published a report, basically, on this, saying, look, if prices continue to decline without a crash, if prices continue to decline and they go another $5 lower than today, okay, we might end up with serious problems in Iraq. So imagine if prices go to 30, what will happen? So that's a big issue. So if no recession, market crash, it will be a flash crash, and then Iraq will start cutting production. Others basically will abide by the rules, and then everything will go up again. If we have a recession, a year, basically 12 months, is enough to recover from a recession and for prices to recover. The general idea here is, yes, OPEC Plus will cut. We've seen them cut before. And if they will cut and trying to keep kind of a price floor in the market. 35 is not acceptable, 40 is not acceptable, 50 is not acceptable, 60 is not acceptable. But they will never talk about prices, because they stopped talking about prices long ago, and they emphasize this point. However, we see a shift right now in the thinking of OPEC Plus, that there is enough evidence for the last 40 years to show that every time they targeted prices, they failed. And therefore, the approach itself is wrong. And that's why they started targeting balances and inventories instead of prices. What that means is, if prices are 90, they are fine. If they are 80, they are fine. And if they are 70, they are fine. But once prices go below and people think, oh, budgets, they want money for the budget. Look, guys, this is really one of the things that the most annoying things I see on Twitter, when people repeat what the IMF is saying and they take it one step farther and they say, well, the break even for the Saudi budget is 110 and they need 110. Complete nonsense. For those who studied public finance, you know what matters is the price used to estimate revenues, not the budget balance. No one look at budget balance and what the price needed for budget balance. If you look at all those budgets in all the oil producing countries, they have an estimated price for the revenues, not the budget balance. And therefore, this idea of the Saudis needing 110 is complete nonsense. And I know Bloomberg is going crazy on that. The second one, the second point is that those countries are very flexible. So prices go below that price to needed to estimate revenues. They have access to, they can borrow from domestic markets. They can borrow from foreign markets. At the same time, they can cancel projects. They can delay projects. They can cut spending. They have many options, basically, to deal with the situation. In fact, Saudi Arabia alone, Saudi Arabia, ran a budget deficit for 21 years in a row. No problem. We did not see them basically going and cutting production significantly and saying, oh, we need to balance the budget. So the point here is, when we look at the next 12 months, it's not really the budget they are trying to focus on. Listen to this. What they are trying to focus on is those countries have national oil companies. What is the price needed to continue investing? No one is talking about this. They talk about shale and what the price needed for shale here in the United States. But why you don't apply the same principle to those guys? They need a certain price to continue investing. If they don't have it, then they cannot invest, then they have serious problems. And they have maintenance and they have other things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So do not only focus on the budgets and how much money they need, focus on what is the price needed basically to maintain production, to maintain their plan basically, because if you spend $2-3 billion on a project and you finish 75% of it, you are not producing, but you don't have enough money to finish the 25%. Imagine the losses. So it's not only the budget, it's other things too. And therefore, when we say they need the prices higher than 60, for example, really, it's really about maintaining production in the field rather than the budget. Back to you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, great. Got now oilprice.com up here. Welcome. What you got for us? Oilprice.com. You've got the mic if you're here. If not, yep.
Do you hear me, Green Candle?
Yep, we can hear you.
Thank you very much. Hello, Dr. Anas. I have a quick question for you. I keep on reading that a potential Trump victory would lead to stricter sanctions enforcement on Iran, leading to potentially lower crude exports from that nation. So what do you think the odds are that a potential Trump administration will significantly reduce Iran's oil exports? Thank you.
Thank you. Before the elections, the last election, before the elections of Biden, we've written a report, and I have several tweets on this for those who want to check them. And in those tweets, basically, I've written that do not be fooled by the increase in Iran's oil production if Biden wins, because people will think at that time that, yes, Iran is increasing production. And the explanation is we have those ghost tankers that's been smuggling the Iranian oil that will appear on the surface. And therefore, companies that monitor them, they will see them and they start counting them and they think it's an increase in production. Now we have the reversal, exactly reversal. If Trump wins and he wants us to enforce the sanctions, many tankers and most of this trade is going to go under. And if it goes under, people will say, look, Trump sanctions are effective. Well, you already have seen a decline in exports of the Iranians. Well, that's not the case. The Iranian regime survived all those years, despite all the sanctions, despite all the war, despite everything else. They survived simply because they perfected their game at smuggling. And the Chinese helped them a lot. They helped them in various ways. They helped them with technology and with finances. And with finances, by the way, just to kind of to mention something, in 2019, the Chinese paid the Iranians in cash, $20 billion. That's why Iran, any country can import oil from Iran. There is no problem. The problem with sanctions is the payments, how they pay them. That's why the Iranians prefer to deal with China, because, or anyone who will give them cash or do barter deals. That's why they have it with Iraq, they have it with China, because they can get it. If they sell it to another country like India, India will take the money and put it in an escrow account in a bank, and they cannot pay Iran. That's why Iran does not want to deal with India. So the issue here is, if Trump wins and we see a reduction in Iranian exports because he's trying to enforce those sanctions, most likely it just that trade is going under. And we did the investigation on this, and we found out that there are 9 ways how the Iranians basically trade this. And by the way, we learned this trick because I personally did the field study on Saddam Hussein and Iraq earlier, in earlier years. And the Iranians learned it from Saddam Hussein, and then they developed it, and then they give that book to the Russians. So there are 9 ways of doing this, and other countries are participating. I think the CIA knows, and probably the White House knows who is participating from other countries. The Iranians have at least 2,000 shell companies around the world trying to get money for everything they export. So it's very hard to see a decline. But here is my last point, which I think the most important point in replying to this question. Trump will never, ever impose or enforce the sanctions on Iran unless he gets guarantees from the Gulf countries they are going to replace that oil. And that is bearish. Back to you.
Great question there. I think we've got a few more. Dr. Anas, I'm just going to try to, or I'm just feeling it out here. Do you have more time for a few more
questions? Yeah, I have no problem with time. So take your time. And I'm not going to watch the debate. So.
Okay, great. All right, hold them. Welcome to the stage.
Thanks for putting me on. So my question actually doesn't relate to oil, but it more relates to what you were saying about China. What are you watching? What are your sources to get a leg up on getting a good beat on a forecast as to how the Chinese economy is doing? Are there people you follow on Twitter? What are the sources? Because it seems like it's such a key to understanding the direction of oil or forecasting oil is to understand China. And I'm just asking this question to see how I could personally get better at understanding China. Thanks very much.
Well, most of the data is public, and the connection, what you need to understand basically, the connection between government policy and this data you get. and you connect that to the trade data to kind of understand. Of course, with trade data, you need to have some subscriptions for that. But understanding the or connecting the dots basically becomes really the issue. I'm going to give you a true example of this and how we got it right. And I think our subscribers were very happy with what we provided them because we told them that they were way ahead of the curve. Basically two stories, and some of you already heard them before from me. The first story is when India refused to receive 14 Russian tankers from Sukhol, carrying Sukhol crude. What Bloomberg and others basically were saying, look, Biden sanctions are working. The price cap is working. The price was higher than the price cap. And Modi is a good guy. That was before the election. And look, he is not buying the Russian crude, etc. So Bloomberg and others tried to make a big story out of sanctions are working, the price cap is working, and Modi is a nice guy. And I am looking at this story, and I'm just like, I don't know. I mean, what to do with those Bloomberg guys when they tell you this? Because in 2020, an Indian company signed a contract with a Russian company to buy Sukhol crude. And the terms and conditions and all that stuff are there. When, after the sanctions, the price of Russian crude basically just collapsed, declined, as you all know. And the Indians basically were looking and said, look, I have the contract price here, and I have the spot market for almost similar crude, $20 less. I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to buy the other one. So if you go the same day that Bloomberg was reporting this story, you go to any of the shipping, the company that monitors shipping, and you look at Russian shipments to India. Never stopped. So where did they come up with the story that they did not buy the 14 tankers because of sanctions and the price cap? And they were buying the Oral basically at that time like $75, $15 above the price cap. Why did they not look at that? So it was just that contract. It has nothing to do with sanctions. It has nothing to do with the price cap. It has nothing to do with any of that stuff. So people were saying, look, sanctions are effective, and therefore we are going to see shortage in the market and this and this. And we're telling them, no, everything will flow normally. There is no problem. So this is one story where you got to connect the dots, basically, and understand what's going on. You got to connect your knowledge of the contracts and what is happening in the market and monitoring that. The second story, immediately after that, like almost a month after that, Bloomberg and others basically were saying, look, demand in China, oil demand in China is going through the roof. Look, they just bought, listen to this, they just bought 14 oil tankers from Russia. Remember the 14 I just mentioned? Because those 14 tankers got stuck at sea for a month. And then the Chinese approached the Russians and said, look, you sell them to me at such a discount, I'll take them and put them in storage. And that's what happened. They put them in storage. So we told our clients, we told our readers, look, they bought this. It has nothing to do with the growth in China. There is no economic growth in China. There is no growth in oil demand. This is an opportunistic buying. They are buying this, and we'll prove it to you, because in 2 weeks, we are going to show you the same amount in Chinese storage. And in 2 weeks, we showed them a chart basically showing them the 28 million barrels that's been added to storage. So these are just two examples on how the data is available. All you got to do is just connect the dots. Back to you.
Thank you so much. And those are great stories. And, you know, always appreciate the chance to ask questions. I just have one follow-up question. As somebody that doesn't have access to these subscriptions and doesn't have access to such detailed info, am I just looking for a big infrastructure stimulus out of China? Like, what would be the hit the highlight thing that you'd recommend that I just keep an eye out to see a turn in?
Subscribe to our daily energy report.
I can give it a shot.
And basically, that's when I mentioned earlier, when I mentioned government policy. It is important if you see a massive stimulus to look at that stimulus and see where it's going and whether it's a kind of only a financial stimulus or really an infrastructure stimulus or it's directed at certain exports. I think that's very, very important to look at. And usually that is public information.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, great stuff. Let's get some more questions up here. All right, Shadi, I think. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that 100%, but welcome to the stage. What you got for us?
Hello, did you say Shadi? I'm sorry, I missed that. Are you giving me the mic?
Yes, the mic is yours.
Thank you so much. Dr. Ennis, regarding Trump, you mentioned the sanction. I think you're right. I do agree that without market compensation, he's not going to impose any more restrictions. However, do you have a read into the renewable energy activities in the U.S. with the Trump coming back? Now, as everybody expects, Harris will continue the R&D and renewables. They pushed very hard for batteries, storage, EVs. Now, given the relationship between Elon Musk and Trump, do you think Biden will go after renewables? Is going to slow down a bit, or he going to support EV infrastructure and might not go after global warming issues?
Okay. We have
because of the relationship.
A few things, and I usually do not express my political views or kind of personal views, but here I'm going to say something personal. My reading of Trump basically is looking at Elon Musk as just a tool, and it's a temporary tool. So it's not a change in his views. This guy, if you study his views, as I did for the last 35 years, he never changed his views. He never did. And whatever he said 35 years ago, he's saying it today. So Elon Musk is not going to change. And the money is not going to change. But I can tell you a few things that are extremely important here. That Elon's interest, basically with Trump, if we are talking about financial interest, not other social kind of principles and other things, GM and Ford basically is getting all the money from the government in billions of dollars. Tesla is not getting it. So from Elon's point of view, if he stops those subsidies to those companies, Tesla can compete without any problems with anything GM or Ford produces in the future. And they cannot compete on prices because there are no subsidies. So the benefit to him basically is stopping the subsidies on EVs is big benefit to Tesla. On the other thing is, and this is kind of important, we are going to see if Trump wins, we will see especially wind energy gets hit really hard, especially offshore wind. So we are going to see the actual reduction in spending, especially on offshore wind. Back to you.
Follow up very quickly. I think that the charging infrastructure that Biden put in place, Elon Musk was kept out of it, as you know. Now, Elon Musk opened all his charging infrastructure. I think, in a way, Trump will not affect that decision in terms of availability of EV charging infrastructure. And I think the subsidies is one, but I don't know why Biden kept Elon Musk out. You know, the whole thing from day one. But I think the wind, I agree with you, because of the way, you know, Trump looks at wind is so...
I'm going to tell you why. Because Tesla employees are not in the unions.
They are not unionized?
They are not. So GM and Ford, they are.
That's political now, yeah. Very quickly, and Doctor, I remember you mentioned something about renewables. You are not very kind of you know, positive in the outlook in terms of the amount of renewable available in solar and wind to compensate for gas and oil. Is this view based on the lack of confidence in storage that is going to be so competitive that we might have enough energy stored to compensate for
intermittent? No. First of all, are you talking about the United States or OECD? What you are talking about?
Yeah, I think I heard you in general. I don't know if this is the right time to
talk. Okay. But you, well, here is the thing. The whole idea was the competition between renewables and oil is extremely limited. And if you are talking about the United States, Canada, Europe, India, China, South Korea, and Japan, that's more than 80% of world oil demand. Even if they double, triple, quadruple, whatever, just use percentage, 1,000% increase of renewables, has almost zero impact on oil. Almost zero impact. And the reason why, because solar and wind are used to generate electricity. And in those areas and countries that I mentioned, oil is barely used to generate electricity. So there is no competition. Now, world oil demand is 104 million barrels a day. Out of those, only about 4.2 million barrels out of the 104, only 4.2 is used in power generation worldwide. And most of that in oil producing countries and in poorer countries and in some remote areas like Hawaii or some of the Japanese islands that are very far away. So the substitution between oil and renewables is very, very limited. And two more points on this. The first one is renewables basically are eating into the coal share, not the natural gas share. And countries, as you know, they want really to get rid of coal as soon as they can. The other issue that is important to this equation, that we, and this is, we are going to see this unfolding before our eyes right now. Naturally speaking, when countries suffer from recessions, when they suffer from low economic growth, naturally, the share of solar and wind increases, and the share of natural gas and coal decreases, naturally. Why? Simply because the sun and the wind does not care about your economic activities. In fact, they don't even care about your borders. Since they don't care about your economic activities, the sun will shine and the wind will blow, and you are going to get the same amount of energy no matter what. And what utility managers will do in this case, because you have lower demand for energy, is they lower, because that's what they control. What they control are the plants that are run by coal and natural gas. So they have to cut energy production, so they cut coal and natural gas. But once you have economic growth, you are going to get the same amount of solar, the same amount of wind, but now you have economic growth and you have to feed it. From where that's going to come? You have to use coal and natural gas. So the expansion of renewables is going to affect mostly coal, but we should not be fooled by the direction or by the percentages that the media is trying to tell us about peaking something, simply because we have low economic growth worldwide. We have serious problems. Some countries are suffering from recession. Germany basically is probably already a recession. So naturally they will tell you, well, look, natural gas demand in Germany peaked. Well, just wait until we see economic growth in Germany, and mark my words. Thank you.
Great question. Thank you for coming on up. Now we got Tempest Logic. I believe it's connecting. There we go. Tempest Logic, what you got for us? Tempest Logic going once.
Yep.
There we go.
Okay. Wanted to quickly discuss MBS and NEOM. I have it on good authority that it is definitely going ahead at a reduced capacity. friends that work in consultancy and what have you. And they're building a city next to the city to house all the contractors, what have you. This is a significant dent on not their budget, but their revenues. Will MBS press ahead with the full project? Can their oil revenues support it?
Does it really matter?
It's $600 billion.
I know. Does it really matter? Whether even if they scrap the whole project. So what?
I assume that he's building it to get away from the muftis.
He already got away with the muftis. The muftis basically are in jail.
Okay, so you believe he is completely running the show there?
Definitely. But the whole issue here is, and this is kind of really striking. We've seen some media reports, basically, and I think they misrepresented the facts. What was the problem of Saudi Arabia with those mega projects? People said, well, there is not enough money. That's not the case. Okay? They literally advertised for engineers worldwide. And there were short engineers in every single project because they couldn't hire enough. And any manager will tell you, please, if you know someone, just send me the CV. Send it to me tonight, please. They couldn't get enough engineers from all around the world. They were hiring left and right. And they couldn't get enough engineers.
Yep.
So the slowdown started for lack of engineers. That's right. Before the decline in oil prices at all. So it started from there. And then as they went through, and just like any other project, they found out basically there are certain things need to be adjusted, certain things need to be this, certain things this, and the cutting started. And this is really where the media started getting the story wrong. For example, they said, well, look at the decline in the amount of the Saudis investing in U.S. treasuries, and look at how much they are withdrawing from it. Well, logically speaking, why their money in treasuries in the first place? So their economy historically was primitive economy. They couldn't invest the petrodollars, and they put them in treasuries. Now you have those mega projects. It's just normal you withdraw the money from treasuries and put them in those mega projects or put them in the fund, in the PIF, because it gets you more money in. So people are missing this idea that in the past, they needed to put money in the treasuries because their economy was primitive. They were not able to invest overseas the way they are doing right now. Now, while they are doing this, they can withdraw the money, make more money, or invest it in projects, do this. So the media, I think, was not fair to them. Now, do they have serious problems? Yes. Do they have mismanagement? Yes. There are all kinds of problems, just like any other country, and probably more. But the idea here is, it is very clear that the media was not fair to them.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. All right. I think we got time for maybe one more before we wrap things up here. Let everybody go and watch the debate tonight. But Yassin, my apologies if I pronounced that incorrectly.
Thank you. I've just got a quick question for Dr. Anas. I'd like to ask your opinion on the developments in the Orange Basin, the Wavis Basin, and offshore Uruguay. How do you find them competing with the American shales, and do you think they can take a sizable amount of the market?
Sorry, you were cutting off a little bit. So which basin you are talking about?
The Orange Basin, the Wavis Basin, and offshore Uruguay.
So, okay. Will you repeat that? I did not hear the names clearly.
The Orange Basin, the Wavis Basin, and offshore Uruguay, the basin there. How do you think they're going to compete in comparison to the shales?
I don't think that, I mean, we will always find oil and gas. And the decline rates are high. And if you look at the recent outlook by Exxon basically says two things that are important, and that confirmed the idea that Exxon Outlook is a PR outlook, has nothing to do with investment. They said two things. The first one is, because of the movement to shale, decline rates went up. And of course, they are them. That's Exxon. And the second thing is, they looked at the IEA and they looked at the United Nations, who asked for asked the companies and the oil producing countries to stop investing in oil and gas. And they said, look, if we stop investing today, the decline rates will be 15% a year. And we have a serious problem with investment any way you look at it, simply because of all the war that we are seeing against oil and gas, the divestment and other things, etc. So the idea here is, we're looking forward, and I'm talking about the next 25 years, if we can get our hand on enough investment, we want to develop anything we can get simply to meet the future demand. So it's not going to be the competition that people are talking about. I'm going to give you an example. Historically, the decline rate is between 4.5% to 5.5%. When you have a recession and oil prices are very low, it jumps to about 6.5% to 7%. Now with shale, probably it's a little bit higher. Probably it's about 8 to 9%. Forget about it. I mean, we'll always have some investment anyway. But take that 8% a year, and after we finish this space, just do the calculations on your own. The crude production is about 85 million barrels a day. Just do the 8% and see how much oil we need in the next, how much new oil, fresh oil, we need in the next 25 years. And you will find out that basically we'll be short any way you look at it. So I don't think there is any fear of competition in this case. Thank you.
All right, great stuff. Well, Dr. Anas, we've been ripping here for nearly an hour and a half, and you've been very generous with your time answering all these great questions. Why don't you tell people where they can find your newsletter and anything else that you got going on here?
As many of you know, I'm very active on Twitter. And in the bio, there are two links, one for the newsletter and one for the Daily Energy Report. As individuals, I advise you to subscribe to the Daily Energy Report. It's $420 a year, but you get, every day, you get a report, you get literally differentiated insights, and you get some kind of chart that you'll never see anywhere else. And for the, if you work for a company, you want to subscribe, whether institutional subscription or individual subscription, you can go for the newsletter, where we do things in depth. Like the most recent report we had was on what we call the European gas tracker, where we track all the gas supplies to Europe. And we are the first one in the world, by the way, to publish this before others. So others basically publish these things like a week later after we publish it. So in terms of timing, we are first. Again, our friend asked me about the data and all this stuff. Get it? This is one of the benefits of having those subscriptions. So those are the two subscriptions. You can get the links from my bio on Twitter. Again, I would like to emphasize that I tweet a lot of things in Arabic, and Twitter had this nice function of translation. Ataqa, which is the media outlet that I mentioned to you, publishes a lot of breaking news and many interviews with officials, articles, etc., just to show you how prestigious it is. The Lebanese energy minister to explain to the Lebanese people what happened with the power outages and all this stuff, he published his article in Ataqa. The Egyptian oil minister, when he wanted to talk about climate change, he published his article in Ataqa. So that's how prestigious it is. So when you see me tweeting, all you get to do basically go to that translate button, just click it, and you will see it in the language your browser in. Brandon, thank you very, very much for inviting me today, and thank you for everyone who joined us today. And for those who still have questions, you can contact me via Twitter, and I'll be happy to answer you. Thank you.
Yeah, great stuff. And this is also recorded, so feel free to share this around. I will be repurposing this and putting it on YouTube and an audio podcast feed as well.
Just one quick comment, if you don't mind. For those who are in Toronto, I'm going to be in the next few days in Toronto. So if you'd like to meet, let me know. Thank you.
Great stuff. Yeah. Great stuff. Yeah. Enjoy Toronto, Dr. Anas. Safe travels. And yeah, thank you so much for your time.